Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Todd James Pierce. Todd James Pierce is the author of the novel A Woman of Stone and the short story collection News World, which won the 2006 Drew Hines Literature Prize. His short stories and poems have appeared in over 50 magazines and journals. He teaches creative writing at California Polytechnic University and lives in Santa Barbara County, California. Hi, Todd. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Jan?
Good. I'm really glad that you're here, I guess, for the Drew Hines Prize and all the way from California.
It's an interesting day here in Pittsburgh.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you what interesting means, but you're going to start to read from your new book, News World.
Yes.
Okay.
The first section I'm going to read is from a story called Columbine the Musical. And one of the things that I wanted to accomplish with this book is I wanted to take a look at how Americans treat news media, television news journalism, as a type of entertainment. And so I'll just read a bit, then maybe we can talk about it afterwards.
Okay.
This is from Columbine the Musical. On Wednesday morning, between math and PE, I learned that Robbie Fenstermaker, who is set to play Dylan Klebold in our school's production of Columbine the Musical, had wrecked a driver's training car and fractured his collarbone. "Collarbone?" repeated Mr. Baxter, my PE teacher. He combed his fingers through his sparse, aluminum-toned hair. "We're talking a good 2 months' recovery," he said. "More if it was a nasty break. When's this place set to open, anyhow?"
"In a week and a half," I told him.
"Better scratch him off the program. He's not doing any acting for some time."
Here was my problem. I was Robbie's understudy. I knew some of his lines. I'd even practiced them with my girlfriend, Susan, who got a little turned on when I imitated Robbie's stage voice. But I never thought I'd need to play this role in the actual production. I was a quiet kid. I'd only tried out because Susan was in the play. I stood there dumbfounded, dressed in our school's PE uniform, blue shorts, gold jersey, my name, Greg Gorman, thickly inked across my chest. After the activity bell rang, Mr. Baxter sent us out for 6 laps while he settled into a beach chair and asked one of his female assistants to bring him a Diet Coke. With the other boys, I ran my laps around our school's new safety track, a quarter-mile circuit enclosed by a 10-foot fence topped with barbed wire. I generally did what I was told and believed this would be the key to my future success. I was good with directions, liked organization, never challenged the teachers or security officers at my school. For example, I was happy in my role as library victim number 4. I was good at feigning panic, good at singing the soft, low chorus of death we all sang, lying on the floor while the other students who played our parents walked through the library holding poster-sized reproductions of our dental records above their heads. I had no real ambition to be the star of anything, let alone our school play. All morning long, I told no one about Robbie's accident, not even Susan, who stood beside me in the lunch line. She was a tall girl with dark blonde hair that fell in a straight line to her shoulders. On that day, she wore the Abercrombie leather necklace I'd bought her as a 3-month anniversary gift and a tank top that showed off her tan shoulders. Occasionally, I wondered why she was going out with me at all. Clearly, football players were interested. But like me, her father had left her family when she was in junior high. I believed we shared something because of this, a certain hopefulness, perhaps, though I can't say for sure what that was. When we got near the front of the line, she pushed through and ordered for us both. I had the same thing every day, a cheeseburger and a Coke. After Susan's father left, her mother had become an executive secretary for a law firm specializing in lucrative class action suits filed by ex-smokers. My mother, on the other hand, experienced repeated episodes of road rage until she finally gave in to the beauty of a quasi-Eastern inner peace and enrolled at the community college to become a certified workplace counselor specializing in conflict management. Because of her, I'd found my own inner peace as well. I looked for the best in other people and had learned that the meaning of life was found in universal goodness. That is, I believed we were all basically good people, just trying to get along, though sometimes, because of our own flawed understanding of the world, we had trouble seeing how other people were trying their best to get along with us. I spent the afternoon in history class, then in study hall, where I worked on my algebra homework, graphing parabolas that stretch toward infinity. After school, I stayed in the library long enough to miss the beginning of our daily rehearsal. As a rule, I hated to be late for anything, but I hoped Mr. Sweeney would select someone else to take the role of Dylan Klebold if I wasn't there on time. Only when the library was about to close that I finally load my books into my mesh backpack, the type of backpack our vice principal had instructed all students to use at the beginning of the school year. I arrived at the theater a good half hour late, my backpack slung over one shoulder, and sat on the outer steps next to a publicity poster for Our Town, the play Mr. Sweeney had directed the previous spring. Though he was interested in what he called the force of negative publicity, he had yet to put up posters for Columbine the Musical, because he was tired of local reporters stopping in to see how we were doing. Already one of these stories had been picked up by the wire service, a short column accompanied by the headline, "Whatever Happened to Hamlet?"
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Todd James Pierce, and he's reading from his new book of stories, Newsworld. I want to start with Columbine the Musical, and you know, you obviously use humor as commentary in your stories. Columbine the Musical is the first story in the book, but I'm wondering how much do you see your work as political commentary, and how much as stories on their own in the world without that agenda?
I think these stories are pretty heavily influenced by an agenda. After the Columbine shootings in 1999, I went out to the school because I felt I needed to have an actual connection with the place. I went out in August after the school year had started, and I spent a couple days in the state archive and pulled all the clippings they had from their clipping service about the shootings and went over to the local library and pulled the clippings they had there. And I also wanted to go on campus for a half hour, an hour, just so I had some connection to the geography. Because what I wanted to do is I wanted to comment on how we as a nation had begun to treat news as a type of entertainment, that we were responding to these news stories that were drawn out over 6 or 8 months as a type of miniseries or as a type of entertainment. And I never wanted to forget the fact that there was a real tragedy behind this. And so I couldn't go on campus during the day. School was in session. So I went over there at 1 or 2 in the morning and walked around the perimeter of the school and looked in the windows and saw the cafeteria and just tried to absorb the atmosphere and the mood. And it was a really creepy experience. And but I felt I came away from that not only with some good research, but with a very small connection to the tragedy there. And 6 months after the Columbine shootings in the New York Times, they reported that there had been over 500 news magazine shows on network news. And by that, they were referring to not the evening news, but shows like 2020 or Nightline. And it became very clear at that point that the newsworthiness of the Columbine story had ended a long time ago, and we as a society were interested in that story for its entertainment value in a dark sense. That journalism uncovers or reveals or reports, and what entertainment does is it makes viewers want to know what happens next. And we had fallen into that mode with that story. And so with the short story I wrote, Columbine the Musical, I wanted to expand through parody one cultural element of that and turn our relationship to that news story into a musical, because that was only 1 or 2 steps away from what I felt had happened in reality.
Mm-hmm. I know you're not portraying this as journalism, but you know, aren't you doing a similar thing by, you know, showing up at the scene and then mm-hmm. and then sort of prolonging the attention on that on this event, even though you're making a parody.
Well, what I wanted to do was not to prolong the event, the attention on the event itself. That wasn't my intention. My intention was to investigate why we were so curious about this event for so long. My intention was to interrogate or to explore our connection to the news in general. And in 1999, my sense is that this was going to be an important story and was going to be a news icon and was going to stay with us for many, many years. And so in some ways, this event kind of fell into that larger observation I was trying to make in my fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And this event became the means of first talking about the way that we relate to the news. That what I saw from my perspective is that network news changed with O.J. Simpson. Though the news had been moving more towards an entertainment structure for some time, with O.J. Simpson, a number of events coalesced so that network news got incredible ratings by running this trial for months, that this trial very coincidentally presented itself as a miniseries with murder, betrayal, with issues of race being played out as though it were a drama. And I think what the news media learned is that if they could package other stories like the O.J. Simpson trial, they could increase their ratings and could increase their market share and sell ads for higher rate.
Okay, well, I want to talk about this some more, but why don't you read, you have other stories that sort of cross some lines that, you know, I think could make people uncomfortable. So why don't you read, what are you going to read, News World now?
I'll read, there's a couple stories in here called News World, and that became the dominant theme for the book. And News World, originally, I wanted to call, News World is a theme park where all of the attractions are fashioned after contemporary news headlines, such as there's OJ's Bronco the Ride, and you can get on these Broncos and tool through a soundstage set like the early 90s L.A. I had originally wanted to call News World CNN World until my agent informed me that that was just begging for a lawsuit. And so it's still set in Atlanta, and it's still a theme park, but now the place is called News World. There are two stories in here, and by far these News World stories take up the most ink in the book. And I'll read you just a little bit of the opening from the first story and then transition into that second story. First story, first section from News World. Every time I saw Tom Jenks, fellow employee at News World, my heart flapped around in my chest like a fish. I forgot to breathe. He looked so good. Tall and casual, hair so thick women would come up to him and say, I'd kill to have hair like that. I was 21 that year, and Tom was 21 as well, a college kid on break. We worked the afternoon shift at a ride called Watergate Hotel, the break-in. He'd stand in the hot Georgia sun dressed like a White House intern, starched shirt and thin maroon tie. How many in your party? He'd asked. Then I'd seat the guest in a reporter-mobile, two in front, three in back, check their lap bars before sending them swerving into a 1/5 replica of the Watergate Hotel circa 1970. And that's generally how that park works. It fashions these cinematic theme park rides after news stories. That story itself is about one designer's attempt to make the park more realistic. I think the obvious observation would be that this is crass consumerism and maybe we should get rid of it at all. His observation, which I think is ironic, is that it's just not realistic enough and it'd be more profitable if we could have more realistic rides inside of, inside of News World.
Let me ask you about the writing of the book. You're owning this agenda that you have about, you know, commenting on the news business as an entertainment business. Most writers who I know sort of find their stories not from project, but find their stories from, or poems, from, you know, sitting down and seeing what comes and seeing what connects and et cetera. So can you talk about the writing of these stories? Because obviously it's happened differently, I would think.
I have a first novel, A Woman of Stone, that's highly personal experience. That is much more of that guised first-person narrative as, you know, fictional author biography. And so I'd gotten to a point in my own writing where I felt comfortable enough with the components of fiction, where I wanted the fiction also to comment on the world around it. And so I wanted the next book to have something large to say about how we live in this country, how we, how we put ourselves together, how we tell stories. When I was first in graduate school, I had this class on Victorian literature, and being a writer, one of the things that I took away was this, that a number of these Victorian novels consciously riffed on biblical stories and what the Bronte sisters could rely upon was that their audience was intimately familiar with these stories, and so they would know when they're riffing on these stories. And my uninformed response to that immediately was, it's too bad we don't have stories like this now. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and when I was a kid in elementary school, I could count on every one of my classmates of having a certain type of film literacy. We had all seen Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Star Wars movies, and we could riff on them in the hallways. We could quote lines. We could act out sections of the movies, and we all knew the narrative beneath this. We all knew the narrative that gave rise to our play acting or to our quoting or to our riffing. And for me, the 90s were about moving away from that. I felt that we really didn't have any large cultural narratives that we shared nationally. My multiplex down at the end of the street from where I live has 14 screens on it. TV, in my neck of the woods, 100 plus channels, and I think there's a migration to the internet, which is just going to fragment that process further. And so I saw that this visual literacy that had replaced the literacy of books, even that was falling away, and we didn't have very many common cultural narratives. And so that wasn't something that I could really use in my writing until I kind of happened on this idea that these news stories, these large news entertainment stories, were this type of cultural narrative that we all carried with us. You know, one of the big movies this last year was that Narnia picture. And I would say less than half of my friends saw it. And so that's not the type of movie that I could riff on in a book. But everyone's aware of the story of Columbine. Everyone's aware of the story of Waco that's in here. The story about the 2000 election, the broken Chads, the delayed ascension into presidency. That's mm-hmm. a story that you can riff on that people carry with them culturally. Mm-hmm. And so that's some of the materials that I wanted to lay out and work with in this book.
Well, I think I might, I don't want to get into a long discussion about this, but I think I might disagree with you about, I think there mm-hmm. are shared cultural narratives
sure.
that may be more located in different groups within a culture.
Yeah.
Shared experiences, certainly.
Yeah.
But you didn't really answer my question
okay.
about how you got to the, as a
Shoot
writer,
me the question again. Okay.
How you got to that material. As a writer, did you set out and say, okay, I'm going to write this story about Columbine? It sounds like you wrote it almost more like a journalist, researching first.
I wrote it almost like a journalist. I researched almost every story first. I went to a number of the locations where I hadn't lived for these stories and spent days there to get the local details right. I had written out of my own experience up until this point, and I had felt that I'd stripped mine, my own life, pretty effectively at that point, and I really needed to look outside myself, that I wanted... I wanted the stories to say something more than, was in my own experience.
Okay. Well, why don't you read some more?
Sure. I'll read you a section from, there's another News World story in there. And it was the last story that I wrote. It was in response to the attacks on 9/11. And for this story, it's the last story in the book. And I wanted to explore how these kids would feel. The kids are in high school. It has a collective we narrator, first-person plural narrator. And I wanted to take a look at, well, if you have grown up in a world where news is treated as a type of entertainment where we tune in not to be informed but to find out what happens next, well, how do you relate to an experience like 9/11? How do you relate to the reality of what's happening on the other side of that TV set? And so I amped it up a little bit and placed it inside the world of News World shortly after the attacks on September 11th. We watched it in social studies, then in world history. That Friday, September 14th, we saw it again in a class called Life Studies. When the jet slammed into the North Tower, Mr. Stoltz, our teacher, squeezed the bridge of his nose pensively, just like he did when he lectured about the dangers of credit card debt. He shifted his eyes to us, his class of 11th grade boys, and asked how we felt about the attack. We weren't good at talking about our feelings, though Mr. Stoltz had made us read a book called The Emotional Life of Men. Our emotions were mysterious to us, the fine divisions between melancholy and depression, yearning and desire. We suspected that someday soon we'd be able to tell the difference between such things, the same way our parents could tell the difference between a good wine and a very good wine. We didn't tell Mr. Stoltz much about our lives. For example, we didn't tell him that Jay Moore had videotaped the attack, then watched it again after doing three lines of Ritalin. Nor did we tell him that Jeff Loeb's little brother Seth had laughed when he saw the first jet exploding into the tower. He thought it was a movie, like Independence Day. After his teacher explained that the planes were real, he cried for 10 minutes before going to recess and kicking a red activity ball over the playground fence. We sat quietly, waiting for Mr. Stoltz to talk to us. From previous classes, we'd learned there were special scripts for talking about your feelings. For example, there were specific things you should say to a friend with a serious drug problem. But we didn't know the script for this situation. Alan Whidden, a boy who had been busted for steroids, said, "It makes me angry." Mr. Stoltz stood there in his starched black T-shirt and iron jeans, regarding us with stern eyes. Harry Kessel, a JV lineman, said, "We should get whoever did this." We were scared, but we didn't know how to say we were scared. The men in our textbooks weren't the kind of men you saw in the suburbs of Atlanta. They weren't the kind of men who told their sons, "Kick some ass in the game this weekend," or, "If you're going to do it, for God's sake, wear rubber." Our fathers went fishing 10 times a year and rode tractor mowers around our weedy suburban lawns. They hung punching bags in our garage, the nylon casings filled with the exact amount of sand to make the bags feel like dead bodies. Initially, we believed the terrorist attacks were something that happened up north, a good ways above the Mason-Dixon line. But then our airport closed, the freeway closed, the mall closed, so did the movie theater. Lastly, Newsworld draped a thick black chain across the entrance to its parking lot, right in front of the attendant booths where Jeff Sanders and Jarvis White had collected the $5 parking fee from tourists all summer long. A professionally printed sign announced national security closure. Most of us worked at Newsworld, an entertainment park 3 miles from our school. We said we hated it, but in truth, we didn't mind it so much. We sold icy and scraped gums off the sidewalk. We stole stuffed animals from the gift shops and gave them to our girlfriends. We thought the job was educational and believed it would help us get into a good college. After my evening shift, I liked to walk through the park. I particularly liked the Vietnam experience. 3 acres so lush you forgot you were in central Georgia. A silver mist rising from vents hidden in rocks. Water dripping from irrigation hoses molded to resemble jungle vines. It was kind of creepy the way it was laid out. The huts made of sticks, military radios and grenade launchers left beside the main guest trail. Sometimes I would meet my girlfriend, Devin McCrae, in the lost Vietnam village. We would make out in the thatched huts while a cool breeze circled around us and the soft voices of the Viet Cong whispered from miniature speakers hidden in banyan trees. We'd grown up with Newsworld the way other kids had grown up with Disney or Six Flags. Our parents had taken us there when we were 7 or 8 so we could walk through an authentic reproduction of a 1950s diner or sit behind the wheel of a 1955 Chevy Bel Air. We were made to watch a clumsy mannequin of Martin Luther King Jr. deliver highlights from his "I Have a Dream" speech, while an equally clumsy mannequin of his wife quivered beside him. We were ushered into the first interactive museum, a newsreel of our parents' life spun out as entertainment. As children, we loved to ride the Kentucky Derby carousel, control the U-Fly 'em fighter jets, watch Neil Armstrong step onto the moon, the gray lunar dust rising up around his opaque boot, while we sat in a cozy reproduction of Mission Control, listening to the brassy fanfare of the Star-Spangled Banner.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Todd James Pierce, reading from his book News World. We don't have a whole lot of time, but I want to... Mm-hmm. There's a lot of moments as a listener where I feel discomfort, and you know, and I'm imagining that as a writer you imagine that happening too. And I'm wondering how you, if that's part of your idea of writing the book, is to make the reader uncomfortable, make the reader think about a lot of things happening.
Yeah, I felt much more uncomfortable when I was writing the first few stories for the book, and then mm-hmm. I grew comfortable with the material. But I think that's a great thing to take away from this, because the feeling of discomfort will hopefully lead to some type of introspection, to taking a look at, well, why do we relate to the news like this? Why has our relationship to the news changed in the last 15 years so significantly and with such meaning behind it?
Mm-hmm. So, that's not my discomfort. My discomfort.
Well, it comes from the humor in it.
Well, what it comes from, you know, the crossing of the lines of, you know, the characterization maybe of, you know, the O.J. Bronco ride in the theme park, mm-hmm. the, you know, the Martin Luther King,
yeah.
you know, taking some things that definitely some people would hold as sacred, even though that's a problematic word, but with the Columbine example and going into that, which mm-hmm. certainly is what writers can do, but
I really see that this is the way that we mm-hmm. treat our own history. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Disney parks, if you go to the Florida park, you can see George Bush, this audio animatronic robotic mannequin of George Bush, on stage speaking to the audience over in the Hall of Presidents. Lincoln also speaks in that same presentation. And it's my experience that in terms of a theme park like this, this is how we treat our history, though making something so contemporary really speeds up the process, and maybe that's where part of the discomfort comes from.
Okay. We're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being here. And just to remind everybody, we've been listening to the short stories of Todd James Pierce from his new book, News World, which is the winner of the Drew Hines Prize in Literature for 2006.
Thank you very much for having me here.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Brian Sawarek, Joseph Wilk, and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved. She had a smile that curved. She had a smile.